Today we're going to be finishing up our survey, and I've made some more improvements to the timeline, which I'll be sending to you. There's a key now on the right-hand side that explains some things, which before I just told you, and then you just had to figure out if you just didn't hear the explanation. So there's a little key on the right-hand side that explains some things. I've also moved the timeline over for the Roman emperors. We had stopped shortly after Theodosius, because he's really particularly important for us, because he was the first, he was the one who truly, you know, completely legitimized Christianity within the Roman Empire, making it essentially illegal in many ways to practice polytheism. And so we ended with him, but this time I went ahead and stretched it out. And throughout the history of the Roman Empires, don't take this as an east-west thing, even though sometimes that's often what's happening. However, here at the very end, this is an east-west thing. This is the western part of the lineage of the rulers, which ends 476 because of the sacking, the repeated sacking of Rome and various Roman institutions by the barbarians of the west. And then, of course, the east continues on for quite some time. The Roman Empire, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, which we tend to think of Rome, the Roman Empire ended whenever Rome fell in 410. Yeah, but not really, because the administrative center at Rome had already moved to Constantinople, and Constantinople remained until 1454. Does that date sound right? A long time, until they were ultimately defeated by the Turks. And so they still continued to call themselves the Roman Empire. They were the Roman emperors who were ruling in the east. So the fall of Rome, though, we have on our timeline back here, August 24th, 410. Rome had not been conquered, entered by a non-Roman force for, 900 years up to that point, which is pretty impressive. But the Vandals, they came in and they did quite a number on Rome. Now, they didn't completely wipe out Rome. Let's just go ahead and start about talking about the sack of Rome. They didn't completely wipe out Rome because, in the Christian institution, because they were Christian. We've mentioned this before. What was different about the Goths and the barbarians of the north in terms of Christianity in the west? Somebody had. Missionary movements had already been up there for quite some time and had been working among them. What was different about their faith? Anybody? They were Arian. They did not recognize the Council of Nicaea. Of course, they were barbarians. They weren't quite as well connected as the rest of the empire. But they were Arian, but they were generally understood as Christians. And so when they were coming in and taking over Christian institutions, the word is that they were actually relatively nice because they at least recognized them as brothers. And so that's the sack of Rome. That's within our time period today. Of course, the main figures we're going to be talking about are two Latin figures.
So, Eric, they would not have recognized the deity of Christ, but would have had...
Arians recognized the deity of Christ. They just did not recognize it in the same way we do. Arians believed that Christ was God, but he was a created being. He was created, which is kind of strange to us to think of God being created. But they would have worshipped Jesus. They would have had no problem with... I don't think they would have had any problem necessarily with the Trinitarian formula. I don't think they had any issues with that at all. It's just their definition of who Jesus was very different from ours. The two figures we're going to be talking about... yes?
Caesar's in now.
What's that?
The Caesars are ending now.
The Caesars in the west are ending. Those in the east continue.
The ascendancy of the Pope, of Bishop of Rome, kind of compared to what we know it is now, is coming up at this point.
Yes.
And in the west, you have the same, but later on, is that what we're talking about here?
You mean in the east?
I mean the east.
The east is culturally very different. We'll go ahead and talk about that now. So, I actually have some slides about the rise of the papacy. So, whenever you think about the fall of Rome, so here's our... we started all the way at the beginning. I'll just do it like this. Here you go. August 24th, 410, Rome is sacked by Alaric of the Visigoths. Three tendencies really kept the church alive at this point. And these are the tendencies that were identified by Friend, William Friend, at this point by far my favorite Christian historian, very much enjoying him. One, intellectual; two, missional; three, and then the papacy. Intellectually, a lot of Christians were identifying Rome with Christianity in the West, or even in the East. They were identifying that, which is ultimately problematic, especially when Rome falls. Because then what happened to Christianity? Our empire fall. Does that mean that Christianity needs to fall as well? And that's the chief danger of aligning politics with religion. You associate one with the other. You associate Christianity with republicanism. Well, the Republicans lose. That means Christianity loses and God lost. That's not a good equation, right? Intellectually, they moved, started saying, okay, you know, we really don't need to see this whole thing as this is the Christian empire and it's going to rule forever. That's fine. A Christian Roman / Gothic empire would be fine. They were able to make that move. And, of course, Augustine was very important in that movement. In his book, City of God, one of his major points was there's the city of man, which is temporal and sinful and entirely messed up. Then there's the city of God, which does not map to the city of man. So he sees the fall of Rome, he sees the problem, and he's writing to solve this, to say, they're not the same. Don't equate Rome with Christianity, specifically the Roman Empire with Christianity. And Augustine lived 20 years after the fall of Rome. He died in 430, whenever his city was surrounded by more barbarians. It took them a while to make it all the way down there, but they eventually did. So the church was able to do that. Because they were able to do that, they were able to survive. Also, they were sending, at this point, missionaries off to the barbarians. Before, there wasn't a big missionary movement from the West. It had happened at a previous time. Arians had sent people up, but the West was not focusing on the barbarians. At this point, they started doing that. And part of that would obviously be countering Arianism. But another thing is the papacy. Valentinian the Third, one of our emperors, if you look back to our timeline, we're in this time frame here, several years after the fall of Rome. Okay, Valentinian the Third. He basically put out a decree and said this: "Inasmuch then as the primacy of the apostolic see is assured by the merit of St. Peter, prince of the episcopal order, by the rank of the city of Rome, and also by the authority of a sacred synod," because they had voted Rome as that place, "lest presumption endeavor to attempt any unauthorized act contrary to the authority of that see, then at length will the peace of the churches be everywhere maintained, if the whole body acknowledges its ruler." And his basic point is this: how are we going to maintain the churches? Okay, acknowledge that one as your leader and follow them. And so the papacy continues to strengthen at this point. We'd already seen it somewhat. We've already discussed it. We saw like the North African bishops, like Cyprian, looking to the Church of Rome and very consciously depending on them. The East, they were kind of lukewarm about Rome. They did think they were very important, but not nearly as much. But in the West, Rome and whoever happened to be the Pope at that time was getting a lot and lot of power. And at that particular point, you've got Pope Leo the First. And what I've read of Pope Leo the First is he's actually a really good Pope. And so, I mean, obviously there's going to be some things, maybe a decent number of things we disagree on, but he's not bad. This often when your negative thoughts about popes come in, that perhaps he's not the best one to associate those with. And so, but yeah, you do have a rise of the papacy at this point, which makes sense. You don't have this Roman government holding things together. What are you going to look to keep your life from falling apart? You're going to look to the church, and look, there's an institution there you can depend on. And so, yeah, this is naturally, I think, going to lead to a rise in the power of the papacy.
Sorry.
Yeah.
At the ascendance of the papacy, I was taught about Mystery Babylon and the Babylonian priesthood,
mm-hmm.
and the parallels between between the two? Is that, is there a connection between what's going on in Babylon and what's going on with the papacy at this time?
I'm not aware of anything like that. Babylon at this point is, there's a lot of Christians there. They're even further eastern than the eastern Christians. We think, you know, west is Latin, east is Greek, but even further east is more Syriac. That group is actually fairly well populated with Christians. And the east, because of various Christological disputes, wasn't really recognizing the Pope very much. And that actually comes into the Council of Chalcedon that we're going to talk about today. And that's one of the reasons why the East, the Far East, really had issues with Rome. So the papacy is definitely growing at this time, and part of it is because it's natural. I really think it is entirely natural for this to happen, given their beliefs in the primacy of Rome. I mean, if you don't tie apostolic succession to a city, these arguments generally don't make much sense, and we don't. But if you do, this totally makes sense. So, what is that? No. Okay. So yes, you're definitely seeing that during this period of time, and it's going to grow and grow and grow. We saw it with Ambrose last time. I remember, whenever he excommunicated the emperor for massacring thousands of people. Right? That was definitely a growth step for the papacy. Where in the East, you don't have the church over the state, you have them one and the same. And the church is the state. And you really get that more in the Eastern Empire than you do in the West. And that remains true even during the Council of Chalcedon, which is, you know, being called after the West has already fallen. The Roman emperor from Constantinople is calling this council to solve these issues and is ultimately running it in a certain sense. So Augustine died 20 years after the fall of Rome. So in his early life, his father was a non-Christian. He was just a regular Roman polytheist. His mother was a Christian. He was raised with a very good education. He had a very good classical education. Nice young man. Then he becomes a Manichee. And Manichaeism was a cross between Christianity and Gnosticism. It was very, very ascetic. Not liking marriage, not liking sex, not liking all sorts of fun things. And so that's Manichaeism. And Augustine gets into that religion, is in it for, as you can see, roughly 9 years. Now, when he ultimately comes out of it, and we do not consider Manichaeists Christians, this is not a Christian sect. Whenever he comes out of Manichaeism, he's very angry at it. And ultimately, intellectually, he comes out of it because he goes and starts meeting with them, and he's super smart. He goes and starts meeting with the rulers, and he's trying to get answers to his questions, and they can't answer them, and he gets disillusioned. Then he moves to Italy, and he becomes a professor in order appointed by Valentinian II. And so he's teaching, and he's at this point starts listening to Ambrose preach. Because Ambrose is a fantastic orator, and he's big into rhetoric. He's really big into to intellectualism, and so he's listening to his enemy. Because he's not a Christian. He's disenchanted with Manichaeism at this point, but he is not a Christian. He's listening to Ambrose, very curious about him, and ultimately through Ambrose's ministry becomes a Christian in 386. He then moves, after a little bit, and part of this is the influence of his mother. His mother continues to dog him about Christianity. She moved to Italy. They are from North Africa, from roughly the same area that Cyprian was from Numidia, from the northern shore west of Egypt. His mother, after he moves up there, she moves up there as well. Her continued influence, along with Ambrose, he ultimately is converted. He then goes back to Africa. He starts a monastery. Eventually he's made a presbyter, and eventually he's made bishop of Hippo in 396.
Yeah. I just want to tell people, if anybody's interested in Augustine, that this should be an inspiration to our Christian mothers, because Monica, his mother, was a Christian. His dad was not. And she saw giftedness in him and prayed, and just wore him out, praying for him, and following him around, and calling him to Christ.
And it eventually happened. And, of course, we all know the story. He eventually becomes one of the most important fathers ever in church history. And so, let's skip Pelagius for a second. In terms of his major subject areas, whenever he becomes a bishop and starts writing, he's really fighting the Manichaeans for a while. Then he gets angry at the Donatists. Now, you remember the Donatists. They've been around a while. These guys are arguing for a very pure church. They've split away from the Catholic Church, both East and West. They've split away saying, you are not being pure, so we reject you, and they have their own sub-church. Augustine is fighting them for a very, very long time. And they remain after Augustine's death, but he really did quite a bit of damage. And whenever he started being a bishop, they were big down there. But even during his life, he was really converting lots of the areas to Donatists. He loved arguing, he loved debating, he would take them on in debates, that kind of thing. And then later on, we've got Pelagianism. And of course, he's a pastor. He's working in the churches. He's preaching. He's writing letters. He's a lot wider than just these three issues. But these are general time periods. You could say, okay, these are issues he's boiled up in. Now, Pelagius, if you've read much in terms of the history of Reformed theology, you've probably read about Pelagius. Has anybody done that? Okay, you've probably read about Pelagius somewhat. Pelagianism is the scapegoat, the bad boy for Arminianism, horribly gone wrong in early Christian history. You can say it that way. He didn't believe in original sin. He did not, at least if you take him through those who are interpreting him and critiquing him, he did not really believe grace was necessary. It was really up to you. It was all coming to faith was all up to you. Being righteous was all up to you. He was an ascetic, and he was constantly critiquing the people in the church for being too lax. He gained a decent following. He started off in Europe. Eventually, he came to Africa. He and Augustine seemed to get along a little bit, but then they started fighting. And then he moved east, and he starts fighting with Jerome, who we'll talk about in a minute. And so everybody's really disliking Pelagius. Pelagius was condemned, not at one of the ecumenical councils, as far as I know, at least not at this age, but certainly in some of the regional councils and perhaps later. So Pelagius, it's really hard to say what he actually believed, because sometimes you'll get people critiquing other people in Christian history, and because they lost, none of their actual writings come down, and so you're not sure exactly what they think, because, you know, as I'm sure you've noticed from polemic literature, when somebody's critiquing someone, they're not usually going out of their way to really explain what the other person thinks. Right? They're going after it. Which generally makes that the worst literature to look at to actually understand what someone really believed. So, he was ultimately excommunicated by the Bishop of Rome. Augustine was appealing for this, and he got it. So, that's Pelagius. He was during this time period. You'll probably read it if you read historical Reformed literature, because sometimes Reformed people will call Catholics Pelagians, and the Catholics are not. We're not Pelagians. Pelagius was condemned, and so they'll, okay, well, you're not Pelagians, so you're semi-Pelagians, and so it's the name call game. So Augustine's later years, his Manichaean roots start coming back. If you look at people in terms of psychology and their general makeup, you can see psychologically things that end up being hang-ups for them throughout their life. Sexuality was one of those for Augustine. And so later on, some of these ideas, some of these Manichaean ascetic ideas come out really strongly in him, and people will often critique him for that. Now, we love Augustine. We really do. But it's mostly because most of the time we have a very incomplete picture of Augustine. You know, we like Luther, but then again, most people actually haven't read Luther. We like Calvin, but most people haven't. Augustine, everybody in the Reformed tradition loves Augustine. But Augustine was perfectly fine with getting the emperor to go persecute the Donatists, which we would not agree with. So, that's Augustine. He has his good and his bad. So he died in 430. The Vandals, this is another group from Europe come down into Africa, was spreading down the west towards the east. They were surrounding the city of Hippo, which is in North Africa, as he died. So, Jerome was another figure. Most people have only heard of Jerome because it was Jerome's Latin Vulgate that eventually became the accepted scripture of the Catholic Church that they used within all of their liturgy, and still do in some areas. That's Jerome. He was very well educated. He really knew the classics. That's what he started coming up in. And ultimately, he rejected his classical training in reading Cicero because of a dream once. He had a dream. He was talking to God. And it went something like this. God said, "Hey, do you love me?" He's like, "Yes, I love you." "No, you don't. You love Cicero. You love him more than you love me." And after that, Jerome was like, "Okay, I got to dump all of this classical learning. I will never again read Cicero." He loved Cicero, the great Latin orator and political guy, alive during the time of Julius Caesar. He loved him, but eventually he rejected it because of a dream that God was basically telling him that he loved Cicero more than him. So he was ascetic. He was disillusioned by Christianity in his native land. His native land was north of Greece, north of Macedonia on the west coast. I think that would be Armenia today. That was where he was from. He was disillusioned. It was kind of lax. He's like, "These guys are lame." He moves around a lot. He spends time with the ascetics in Egypt and Syria, in that area, seeing what the ascetic life was all about. That's Jerome. Here's his general idea. The church, after it had arrived at Christian princes, became greater in power by its wealth, but less in virtue. So he was critical of the move of Christianity into power. Maybe not theoretically, but at least in practicality, because he recognized when that happened, okay, Christianity became a lot more wealthy, but a lot less virtuous. So he moved to Jerusalem. He actually moved around quite a bit. He was in Jerusalem for a decent portion of his life, and a lot of the time when he was fighting Pelagianism. So he got in fights with Pelagius too. So him and Augustine were on the same side there. Somewhere around 385, he was commissioned to start the Vulgate. And he did not ultimately translate all that became the Latin Vulgate, but he did most of it and was the one who started it. Now, by this time, they had already had Latin translations of the scriptures into their language. The textual critics just make this distinction, called Vulgate and Old Latin. And the emperors were trying to say, okay, let's come up with something that's a little bit less lofty. Let's get something sort of the language of the people. Let's have a new translation that we can standardize on. And ultimately, that's what the purpose of the Vulgate was. And he was the one to start it. He grew up Latin, but through his travels, learned Greek and Hebrew, and was doing his translation from the original languages, because he really was an intellectual. He was a scholar. Great guy. Yeah. Vulgate, I believe, comes from, like, similar to our word vulgar. It was a translation of the New and Old Testament and the, what we call the Apocrypha, horrible name, into Latin. And it did not immediately become, but eventually became, the standard translation. So that is the what is called the Latin Vulgate, or Jerome's Latin Vulgate, is the standard Latin translation of the Greek and Hebrew and slightly Aramaic New and Old Testaments. So that was the Vulgate.
I think there's a point here probably for some of us, because we Baptist, and growing up in Louisiana, Catholics were predominant. And so you hear Vulgate have sort of a negative association, but in this early time in the church, it was an attempt to make the Bible accessible to more people. Now, I think definitely the Roman Catholic institution's history is that they, after they got it into Latin, they didn't want to let it be translated into the language of the people, because when people can read, it tends to empower them, and they wanted to maintain centralized power. But I think in terms of church history, mm-hmm. it's probably a good thing.
It absolutely was a good thing. And you're absolutely right. It was so the people could read it, and so the church could standardize. And we, of course, use a lot of different translations. There's benefits in that, because translation is always also an act of interpretation. And so being able to see the text in different translations is valuable. On the other hand, standardizing on a particular text is also valuable. Because if you have your kids memorize a verse, and you have your kids memorize a verse, and there are different translations, you say, "Hey, what is John 3:16?" And they both start speaking, and they start saying different things, because they're just slightly different wording. Right? Well, there's some value in some sort of standardization, but that's what they were trying to do with the Vulgate, and they did, and it was very useful for a very long period of time because people in the West knew Latin. Eventually, you're right, when they stopped knowing Latin, they should have made the next step, and oh, okay, well, we need to translate this into this other language, and they didn't, which is a shame.
Translate our English Bible? They go from Latin?
It certainly would have affected it. In the modern translations, they're not going to be really looking at the Vulgate much. However, modern translations are going to be affected ultimately by the past English translations, which are ultimately going to be affected by the Vulgate. And so, yeah.
The King James Bible, did they use mostly Vulgate, or did they use...
I think they actually used mostly Greek and Hebrew. Okay. I could be wrong on that, but I think that's true. But they also based a lot of their work on earlier English translations. And so, probably more Wycliffe, because Erasmus didn't really do English.
That's right.
Because, you know, Latin was the language for Erasmus. So, yeah, the Vulgate, very important. And if you want to talk about just total number of manuscripts of the New Testament, the most common manuscript we have is manuscripts in Latin from the Vulgate, because they were copied so many times in the West. So the fall of Rome, talked about that. Okay, so councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon. And so by this point, we've established that Jesus is God. Okay, we established this back at the First Council of Constantinople. He's not a created being. That's crazy talk. So what do we need to talk about now? So the Council of Ephesus and the Council of Chalcedon were ultimately talking about the nature of Jesus. All right, they've already accepted. We're good with. Yeah. Okay. So you know we're good with Nicaea and Constantinople. We accept that without addition. We're not trying to without changing the thing. What we want to talk about then is what Jesus is human and divine. What does that mean? So what they condemned was something called Nestorianism. And Nestorianism is one of those cases that I just mentioned about Pelagius, where it actually doesn't look like Nestorius believed what Nestorians believed. Okay? Where Nestorius believed a certain thing, and then they critiqued Nestorius on something he didn't really believe, and ultimately that got condemned. And of course, Nestorius gets condemned because of that, and he's just going, I don't even agree with what you're condemning. But, you know, fun times. So that's Nestorius. Nestorius was a bishop in Constantinople, and what ultimately was his version of Nestorianism, and perhaps what was in what they were condemning as Nestorianism, was fairly common in the Far Eastern Church. So if you think about the map, markers right here. Okay. So when we think of Christianity, and pretty much all of this presentation has been along these lines, right? So here you go. Here's Egypt. You know, Augustine's over here. I keep saying Augustine, but I know I should say Augustine. There's the Black Sea. Okay. Constantinople's here. Here's Greece. So when we think of Western Christianity, that's here, right? When we think of Eastern Christianity, Greek Christianity, that's Eastern Greek. That's Greek Christianity. And these things are broken down by language lines. This is naturally going to happen. If you speak a different language, you're going to theologically develop different than someone else because you can't talk. Over here, and this goes back to Babylon, which is, you know, Tigris, Euphrates, you know, whatever. Over here, Christianity is blooming, just like it is over here in the Greek speaking. These guys are speaking Syriac. Okay? And then down here, cut this off, actually probably more like right here, down here you've got African Christianity, and they're speaking Coptic. Okay, so the Syriac-speaking Christians are often called, and they are still around today, often called the Nestorian Church, because they generally went with Nestorius' version of things, and it's kind of hard to even tell exactly what he thought, but... That's this group here. And whenever, and this goes back to the whole the Babylon thing, whenever the Council of Chalcedon happened and they condemned Nestorius, that's going to create a split over here. And of course, the churches fundamentally work differently in terms of their cultures. The West, it's about the papacy at this point. They're really the chief. As long as there's not a really weak pope, they're following the pope over here. Pope Leo I, he's very strong. They're big fans of Leo. He was around, he was alive during the times of Ephesus and Chalcedon. So Chalcedon is, by the way, right next to Constantinople. The council was supposed to happen there. They just moved it next door. And so these guys are big pope over government, ultimately, is where they go. These are big bishops, multiple, and Constantinople gets the primacy of these guys, but ultimately the emperor is the chief of the Christian empire. Over here, you got less of a connection with Christianity and government because, they just didn't develop that way. And then in the 600s, whenever you got Islam coming in and spreading, then, well, you've got Muslim rulers anyway, and obviously they're not going to say, oh, Muslim leader, you're the head of the church. They're not going to go that way. So there's your rough groups. And so these guys are then distanced from the Eastern Christians and the Western Christians, not these guys, because of these two councils. And so the Nestorians, they accept Nicaea, and they accept Constantinople. They do not accept Ephesus and Chalcedon. So what Nestorius was doing, or at least Nestorianism, as it critiqued, was it was making too large of a distinction between the divine part of Jesus and the human part of Jesus. Tell me if they use this for those of you who grew up in Catholicism. Theotokos, do they use that term in Catholicism? Okay. What they do use is they do frequently call Mary the Mother of God. Correct? Correct? Right. That's what that word means. This is one of the words that they really fought over in Ephesus. Nestorius did not like this term, Theotokos, Mary Mother of God. He wanted to distance somewhat, to say, okay, Jesus was fully divine when he was born, but really she's more of just the mother of the human part of Jesus, not really the divine part of Jesus. How can a human woman birth a divine thing? He critiqued this term, and this term was important in Christian theology and Christian ideas, both in the East and in the West. And so when he critiqued that, that really got him in hot water and ultimately led to his condemnation. He had to leave his bishopric. But ultimately, some of his ideas, which would not be as extreme as what they were really condemning, lived on and still live on in the Eastern Church. And by the way, I'm reading some of the Eastern Church right now. It's very interesting. Did not know this, but the Eastern Church was thriving well up until the 10th, 11th, 12th century. Thriving as in total numbers-wise, as much as what you have in the Greek-speaking and then in the West, in Europe. Then this is hundreds of years after Muslim rule has started. And even after Genghis Khan comes in, Christianity is still alive and well. It's spread very far east. You've got partially into China. You've got Christians in among the Mongols. That group of Christianity, very, very alive. And even still down here in Coptic Christianity in the north. Around 10th, 11th, 12th century, that's when the various groups start going haywire and start massacring them. They did not, the Muslims and the Mongols did not persecute the Christians like the Romans persecuted the Christians. The Romans would usually go after the leadership, destroy the books, destroy the buildings. Don't just genocide. Well, different groups, different time periods, different reasons. You start getting genocide all through Western Asia, Middle East, North Africa, and Christianity is mostly erased. When I think it was Tertullian said, martyrdom, the blood of the saints is the seed of the church. That's only true if they don't kill all of the Christians. If there's no Christians left to evangelize, well, it just goes away, and there's not much you can do about it. That's ultimately what happened with this church. But it was alive and well for hundreds of years after this. Which means you've got hundreds of years of peaceful interaction between Islam and Christianity, when eventually the ruling faction just decided to go crazy. So here's the Confession of Chalcedon. Ephesus is still considered an ecumenical council, but the guy who was really running the council was ultimately condemned by this council for being mean, for being really nasty in the way he was trying to deal with those he disagreed with. But this is the general statement that comes out of it. "We then, following the Holy Fathers, all with one consent, teach people to confess one and the same Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, the same perfect in Godhead and also perfect in manhood, truly God and truly man, of a reasonable soul and body, consubstantial with the Father according to the Godhead, and consubstantial with us according to manhood." So you've got some elements of Nicaea in here, right? They're not changing anything with Nicaea. They're just adding on. So they're, instead of just focusing on the deity of Christ, they're saying consubstantial with God, consubstantial with man, all at the same time. "In all things like unto us without sin, begotten before all ages of the Father according to the Godhead, and in these latter days, for us and for our salvation, born of the Virgin Mary, the Theotokos, Mother of God, according to manhood, one and the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, to be acknowledged in two natures, inconfusedly, unchangeably, indivisibly, inseparably." So you can't really confuse them. The divine nature is different than the human nature. Unchangeably, well, he didn't change. I guess that's what they mean. Indivisibly, but you can't divide him. You can't confuse him, but you can't divide him, because he is both God and man. "The distinction of natures being by no means taken away by the union, but rather the property of each nature being preserved and concurring in one person and one subsistence, not parted or divided into two persons, but one and the same Son, and only begotten, God the Word, the Lord Jesus Christ, as the prophets from the beginning have declared concerning him, and the Lord Jesus Christ himself has taught us, and the creed of the Holy Fathers has handed down to us." So that's the Confession of Chalcedon. And so that is the fourth of the generally recognized ecumenical councils. And that's ultimately what they came up with. And, like the other councils, there were canons that were published along with this about various different church matters, which we won't talk about today. But they're worth reading. They're interesting. And that's it. So that is Christianity through roughly 450, 451. And the West, we're heading west straight into the Middle Ages, into what is called the Dark Ages. And it obviously, okay, somebody comes in to America, they conquer us, they burn down some of our libraries, they destroy all our political institutions. What's that going to do to our education? It's going to have some negative effects, right? This is happening in the West, obviously, because they're being conquered. That's just kind of natural. And so, yeah, in the East, you're going to continue with a very strong intellectual movement, both in Turkey and also further east in the Syriac world. I heard they were continue to be quite astute. In the West, that's going to be problematic. In the East, they're still studying Aristotle. They're still studying Plato. They're getting into all that. In the West, they're just trying to survive, and they're hanging on to the church to be the thing that really holds them through. And so, sure, the Dark Ages are naturally going to be, at least at their beginning, rather dark. Eventually, you do get strong intellectual traditions that start in the West, and ultimately you get to the Renaissance, but not immediately. Immediately after that, you're going to have issues. So, of course, the popes after that, and it's going to be different in different areas. Rome still is going to be a very important city. If you want to go for learning, that's probably still going to be a great place to be, because the papacy, well, they're hanging on to their books. They've still got them. They still have a tradition there. And that's probably going to be true in certain cities, but general disarray. Of course, the missionary movements are also going to keep it alive. Monasticism ultimately ended up being very important for the West in terms of its missionary movements, because you'd get monastic groups. The Kenobitic monasticism that we talked about, they'd go somewhere, they'd place their roots there, and then try to spread the gospel. These groups are going to be also important for keeping the church from falling into total and utter disarray and also lack of knowledge. So technically, I think we're out of time. But anyway, that's the end, and that's the end of our survey. We'll still chat for a while if you want to stick around. So, yeah.
Just to summarize the Chalcedon thing, if I'm getting this right, they're trying to explain the deity of Christ and humanity of Christ in an attempt to try to explain it. They bring Mary into the mix to say she's the mother of God is sort of what they're saying.
So the debates...
The Catholics today are kind of nutty.
That's different. Where they ultimately went with starting to say that Mary was sinless. Okay, well, that is related to this.
Okay.
Really trying to raise Mary higher. Okay, tangentially related to this. But they're not arguing that at this point. At this point, they are arguing for the perpetual virginity of Mary. Some are, some are not. Jerome argued very strongly for that. And one of the reasons why is apparently for them, one of the largest arguments for ascetic and monastic Christianity is Mary's virginity. Who is the greatest normal human, right? Jesus is God. You can't quite, identify with him completely. I mean, that's not fair. But Mary, she's totally human. And so what did she do? Well, she was perpetually a virgin. And so, hey, that must be a great way to live. And so if you take down the perpetual virginity of Mary, you lose some of the spiritual awesomeness which goes along with monasticism. And that's essentially where they're coming from. So yeah, you're going to be getting that pretty strongly at this point.
Yeah, and that continues with this Mary cult that's current in Roman Catholicism now. The town where I grew up, the name of the main Catholic church in the city was called Immaculate Conception, or the Church of the Immaculate Conception, which is a doctrine that came later that Mary was immaculately conceived, like Jesus, which is nowhere in Scripture.
Oh, it's not referring to Jesus when they say
no.
That?
No.
I've heard that term. I assume they meant
talking about the birth, conception and birth of the Virgin Mary. And so it becomes, in my opinion, later on, just almost like another religion. Because there becomes actual worship of Mary. Now, I don't think Christians should ever denigrate Mary, but I think when we're dealing with Catholics, we have to draw a very firm line and say it about what we say about
Christ's mother. And so these ideas about Mary, these are not a 4th century thing. In the 2nd century, you've got a work that's written. I've read it. You've read part of it.
Yeah.
The Protoevangelion of James.
James, the brother of John, or Jesus?
Supposedly. Yeah. So this book is Protoevangelion. It is the previous gospel. You can get it. You can find an English translation for it on the online. And the basic purpose of this is this very idea. You've got witness in there. Has anybody heard that Jesus was born in a cave and that's what the barn was? It's actually a cave. That's one of the traditions. You see that in the Protoevangelion of James. So you've got some of these ideas in the 2nd century. So it's not a later development. I mean, maybe later than first group Christianity, first generation. But this is not a late Catholicism thing. This is a 2nd century the Christians are going this direction. Certainly not as much as the later Christians would, and what you see in Catholicism. In the East today, they still venerate Mary. But if you think about it, and you have a strong idea of having saints and a group of saints that you specifically canonize, she's the best. I mean, all the other guys are great, but she birthed God, right? You can't beat that in terms of sainthood. And so anyone who has that view of the world is going to have Mary up on top. And so this thing is kind of natural. Now, I bought a book recently, which I haven't had turned to read. It's about this thick. It walks through... Yes?
Excuse me, Eric. I got a note. Yeah. I found 2 pieces of currency outside the door of the sanctuary. Everybody check your pockets if they dropped anything.
If nobody claims it, it was mine. I've got a book that goes through the rise and all the writings of the early church fathers on Mary. I really want to read it so I can see where more of this goes. But so you see it in the fathers, and you also see it in pseudepigraphal works. And so it's called the Protoevangelium of James. Nobody thinks James, the brother of Jesus, wrote that book. Nobody does. Nobody in the academic world thinks that James, the brother of Jesus, wrote that work. They all recognize that, okay, this is a second century document that's talking about Mary and bringing out some of these traditions. And it mentioned that, you know, Joseph, he was old and he didn't want to marry. He just sort of takes her on to protect her. So he's talking about the perpetual virginity of Mary.
Explain the brothers and sisters?
Yeah, they were all from a previous marriage of his. Which is possible. It's possible. I don't think it's true, but it's possible.